You're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks. I'm Christopher Jones and I have Matthew Rushing here with me. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Chris. How's it going?
It's going quite well. And I was really happy with our last episode where we talked to Kirsten Baer, and I think our listeners were too. We've gotten a lot of great feedback on Twitter from that.
Yes. I had such a good time talking to Kirsten. She's just a great author, one, and just listening to her talk about her passion for Voyager, how much she knows about Voyager, was really interesting. I hadn't even considered that there's somebody out there who's watched each episode maybe 10 to 15 times, and so having that kind of devotion really shows up in her writing.
It does. It was very interesting to me, just that insight into Voyager. Very different angle from what you've heard on other shows in the past, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, it really, again, when you pick up her books and you are reading through them, you are seeing every bit of potential in each of the characters that you had really hoped would be there when you first watched Caretaker. And then, of course, were subsequently let down in as the series went on. And so, and I'm really glad that they have just kind of given her a full rein to work with these characters and kind of make them into everything I think we've hoped they could be. So,
yeah. And speaking of giving her full rein, and I thought she did a great job of not revealing this little tidbit on the show, because, you know, we want to keep it under wraps, but the way that she's going to bring in, and she's going to have Lieutenant Monkey from Resolutions as a regular bridge crew member in future novels, I thought that was brilliant. And, you know, since the Vic Fontaine days on Deep Space Nine,
yes,
I've never seen the creative heads give that much latitude to the writer.
Well, you know, with having Lieutenant Monkey show up, I think that Voyager books are just going to take off. You know, she didn't want us to reveal, but I'm really glad to be able to tell our listeners that's actually going to be the cover for the next Voyager book.
It should be, because, yeah, you know, cover art is really important for sales, and especially if you want to get on that New York Times bestseller list. I don't think, maybe short of Spock, maybe, I think Lieutenant Monkey is the only way to go.
Well, yeah, and especially Lieutenant Monkey in his Starfleet uniform. It's
right.
It's something to behold.
It really is. All right. Well, before we jump into news, let me ask you, Matthew, as you head into what I suspect is probably a rather warm winter in Texas, what are you spending your time reading these days in the Star Trek universe?
Well, had just finished the latest David Mack book, which is was excellent. Silent Weapons, really enjoyed that. The review is up on the site. And just got a copy of Federation, the first 150 years. And so I'll be working my way through that and writing up the review for Trek FM. And really neat, when they sent it to me, one of the ladies sent me a note. And so we will be able to have the author on once I finish the review. And so we'll be able to set that up and have him on the show and talk about that book. So I'm really excited. I got a chance to look through this book just a little bit so far. It is beautiful. If you are looking for something to get that Star Trek fan in your life, something for Christmas, this is really it. It's incredible. And The Stand, I mean, it talks to you in Hukaro Sulu's voice. Unfortunately, it does not say, yeah, it doesn't say, oh my, but yeah, there, you know, it really is. It's so cool. I loved it.
I think it should. I think they should program it so that as you flip through the history of the Federation, as in the history of any culture, there are those moments that are just very surprising. And I think that when you flip to that page in the book, it should say, oh my.
Yes, that would be excellent. Kind of like those cards, you know, they have now that you open them and you get the nice little song that plays. So every time you turn that one page, it's like, oh my.
I think that would be an excellent touch. Maybe the history of the Federation, the first 150 years, second edition, will include that feature.
Yeah, it really could have only been made better when I was flipping through if, you know, Sulu's voice had come through with those dulcet tones of, oh my.
Oh my.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into news. And while we're talking about these types of reference books, in a way, let's talk about our first story, which is the Star Trek Visual Dictionary, which is coming from Dorlan Kindersley.
Which, have you seen those visual dictionaries before? The ones they do for, like, Star Wars and...
I have, in fact, because actually our illustrator, Isaac, who does all the artwork for Trek FM, he used to work for Dorlan Kindersley, and he actually used to work on these visual dictionaries.
Excellent. So you know exactly how awesome they are. And I think, you know, it's long overdue for us to get one for Star Trek. I mean, they've put out 1,000 Star Wars of these.
Yeah.
You know, every time George Lucas decides to change something, they have to go and make us a new one. And so this is going to be really cool. They actually just changed the cover art a little bit a few days ago, and but it's got the Borg Queen on there, Spock, as well as Worf, and some tricorders and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be a really fun treat for fans just to kind of have a big visual reference guide of all the props used on the different Star Trek series.
It really will. And the artwork in these is always so excellent. So having that detailed view, because actually the artwork in Star Trek the Encyclopedia is not always great. You know, sometimes it's not very detailed. I have a feeling that what we're going to get in here, if the past visual dictionaries are any indication, will be really excellent. A high-quality view of the Star Trek props and the technologies that we haven't seen very often in the past.
Well, and I'm hoping that everybody will get a copy of this and that they'll want to do more of these because, you know, for the Star Wars books, they've done the big schematic books where you pull it out and you can see the cutaways of all the different types of ships. So I think that that would be something that they could really do, obviously, for Star Trek, giving us, you know, the Enterprise, but also Cardassian ships or Klingon ships or Breen ships, you know, especially those ships that we haven't really seen very much of. This would be a perfect opportunity for them to be able to do. So I'm really hoping this does well, so they'll be encouraged to do something like that.
And I'm definitely looking forward for the pullout cutaway in this one, where they actually show you the entire technology behind Chief Engineer Argyle's gin distilling setup that he has in the Jefferies tubes.
Yes, I'm hoping it's not too detailed because I'm worried about kids trying to replicate that with the hot water heater in their houses. But what I thought you were going to say was with the schematic pullout of exactly what is underneath Seven's suit.
Yeah, that's a special edition of the book. I think it's only going to be available from certain retailers.
Yeah, and unfortunately, too, we're going to have to talk about the rest of that in our After Dark show. So
that's right. So while we're talking about ship cutaways, let's jump down to one other related story in the sense of ship schematics, and that's the Onboard the Enterprise book that's coming next year from Mike and Denise Okuda, because this is going to be giving us cutaways as well of the Enterprise D.
Yeah, which, you know, did you ever get the Enterprise D schematics that they did?
No, I have. I've always wanted those, but I've never been able to actually get my hands on them. I'm going to buy them eventually.
Yeah, I had them all, and I had them all laminated. And so they were really, really cool, but it was really clumsy because they were huge. You know, they're larger than most poster sizes. And so I think this will be really neat because it also comes with the CD-ROM and it'll give you an opportunity to do some of those kind of things on the computer where you wouldn't normally, you know, you might have to fold out a big, huge sheet of paper with this on there. I think that's going to be really nice and probably give us a look at some of the areas on the Enterprise D that, you know, we never really got to go to on the show.
Yeah, because we only got to see a tiny part of that ship. It's such an enormous ship, and, you know, I could probably count on my two hands the number of actual locations that we got to see on the show itself. So I'm looking forward to this, too, and everything that Mike and Denise do is always fantastically done, so I'm looking forward to that. Now, these are both going to be out in March of next year. Mm-hmm. The Visual Dictionary releases on March 20th. 2013, and the Onboard the Enterprise is going to be out on March 7th. And yes. I think you can pre-order both of these from Amazon, probably some other places right now.
You can, and they're actually both really well priced. These aren't really expensive items, and so definitely something I think to pick up. Be fun to be able to share if you have kids. This is definitely the kind of thing to allow them to kind of explore and kind of really get into Star Trek in a way maybe they haven't. And, you know, there's nothing like being able to flip through. I remember as a kid, I would get those kind of books out from the library all the time. And there was nothing like getting to flip through those.
So let's move on into novels now and see what we have up in news there. You found out a little bit, I believe, about what David Mack has coming up.
Yes. And actually, David Mack and James Swallow and David R. George III, and Una McCormick, and Dayton Ward are all going to be working on a 5-book series that's going to be coming out starting later fall 2013. And it's going to be called The Fall. It's a 5-book series. They'll be loosely tied together. And it'll be revolving around the Typhon Pact series. And so it's going to be really good. These are some of the Trek's greatest authors right now. And so I do know James is going to be writing the Titan novel in that series. And I had heard that Una will be working with Picard and Garrick. So that should be on Cardassia. So that should be really interesting. I'm not sure exactly who David and Dayton will be working with. But this is going to be, I think, an epic series. I get the feeling with all these people involved, something big is going to change. So I'm not sure what to expect, but it's called The Fall. So I'm wondering if somebody big might die or something. I don't know.
I would certainly expect something big will happen with, like you said, these are 5 of the biggest authors in Star Trek at this time. And so if you bring them all together, it should be a, what shall we say, a quadrant changing, a galactic changing event that takes place in the fall.
Yeah, so I'm really excited. I love it when they do these kind of series. We have seen this in the Typhon Pact already, doing these kind of loosely based series, and so I think this is just another great opportunity to give us some great character growth and really meshing some of the 24th century together in a way that we've always kind of wanted them to do. And since we obviously won't get any of those movies, well, hey, at least they're still giving us the Prime Universe in the books.
And as they said when I was a kid, you read a book and take a look at the TV in your head.
Exactly.
So, all right. Well, speaking of James Swallow, he has the new book, The Stuff of Dreams, coming up. And believe that he revealed a little more information about this recently.
He did. On his website, some of the different Trek authors were kind of passing around this funny meme, basically, of answering questions about their newest books. And so his next book will be a Next Generation ebook novella. It's going to pick up some storylines from Generations. It'll actually take place after David Mack's series, but it's kind of based on a role-playing game scenario from a defunct TNG RPG game, And he's kind of been kicking it around, he said, for several years, and he's really excited. And so he thought he'd pitch it, and they went for it. And so he's going to try and have the story be something of a later feeling Next Generation episode from some of the later series. And he says that the one sentence synopsis is, when Captain Picard is summoned back to the mysterious space-time phenomenon known as the Nexus, he and his crew become embroiled in a desperate plot to rewrite history, no matter what the cost. What do you think?
It's hard to say. I just wonder Lieutenant if Guinan Monkey? Will be there. It could be. Maybe. Maybe Lieutenant Monkey eventually becomes captain of Voyager. There's a coup d'etat. Captain Monkey becomes Emperor Monkey of the Federation.
Oh, goodness, I like
it. And Picard has to go back into the Nexus and rewrite history to save the Federation from its greatest threat, Lieutenant Monkey, Emperor Monkey.
Well, and what's interesting is that this is not the first time that the Nexus has been used. David R. George III, in his Crucible books, used the Nexus as well as the Guardian and the Edge of Forever to help Kirk defeat Death in his Crucible book, Kirk. And so the Nexus has been used in kind of a strange way again in conjunction with Generations. And so I'm really interested to see what's going to happen in this, because it does sound fascinating to me that somebody might be trying to use the Nexus to change time somehow. So
right. Yeah. Yeah, it does sound interesting. From the synopsis, yes, there's no indication as to what the story will be other than Captain Picard and the Nexus. So
yeah, it is we'll almost as, you know, maddening trying to figure out as who the actual villain in the next Star Trek film is. So
right. John Harrison.
Exactly, because who is that? Oh, goodness.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, so that's going to be coming up. And then Dayton Ward shared a little bit more about his next big thing.
And the same way on his blog that James had done, he just decided to give us a little bit more information. It's going to be set in the original series universe. It's a standalone story. Utilizes 1950s UFO paranoia, the Cold War, and the escalating space race in the 60s as a backdrop for a Star Trek tale in the vein similar to the New York Times best-selling Eugenics Wars duology. So this should be just a really interesting book. I think, you know, Dayton was giving us a little bit of information. It's kind of slowly leaked out more and more what he's going to be doing. And so I think connecting all those things with a Star Trek bent is going to be a really interesting read.
It should be. These kind of books are always interesting, where it kind of ties Star Trek into our own world a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely always a fun thing. And it sounds like Dayton's having a lot of fun just doing this book and putting it all together and trying to tie all those little pieces together. And so,
yeah, definitely. Okay, well, let's head over now to comics and find out what we have up there. We have a little bit of news about new releases coming up and a little bit of news about some delays that we've seen.
One of the cool things was that John Byrne had come out with some information about a compendium of his work that's going to be coming out in 2013, a hardcover collection of all of his Star Trek stuff. He's written some really great stuff: Assignment Earth, Crew, Frontier Doctor, and all of Romulus. So all of this is going to be gathered for the first time into one collection. I've been meaning to get Frontier Doctor digitally because I really wanted to read that, because I love McCoy. But I've looked at some of his other stuff. He writes great stuff, and I really enjoy the artwork in here. And so I think this is going to be a really cool collection, and I'm really glad that IDW is taking it upon themselves to kind of go back and help fans really rediscover some Star Trek comics that they might have missed before.
Definitely, because I think a lot of fans are probably like me, who, although I like reading the comics now, I haven't always been into the Star Trek comics over the years. Sometimes I'm into them, sometimes not. So I've missed huge amounts of the Star Trek comics themselves. You know, if you go back into, you know, the 90s, especially that time period, I missed quite a lot of the comics.
Yeah.
So this is a great opportunity for people to catch up, and it's great for them to come back and make these things more accessible for everyone as well. Now, this is going to be a hardcover collection. I do wonder if this is going to be available digitally as well.
You know, I was hoping the same thing, and mainly because for me, and I know you do the same, I like to read the comics on my iPad. It makes it a lot easier to have them accessible all the time, because especially comics, it's so nice to be able to have something to read just very quickly when I'm just out and about and I just need something to read, but I don't want to be, you know, necessarily kind of get bogged down in a whole chapter of a book and just pull out one comic. And so I am hoping they'll do that. But I noticed this is going to be coming out in April. So it does look like not only is IDW helping fans rediscover the comics, but that does look like they're going to be trying to capitalize on Star Trek Into Darkness coming out and having something for the bookstores to be putting on the shelves next to all that Star Trek stuff they'll have out. And so I think this is great. You know, fans are going to be going into the stores, coming back from the movie, wanting to get more Star Trek. And, you know, as we both know, the Star Trek books are fantastic, the comics are fantastic, and this is just a great way for new fans to really get connected with the old series. And so I'm really excited for this.
That's a real key, too. It's one of the things that I tell people who don't really like the J.J. movie or the Abramsverse take on Star Trek, is that, you know, the fan base is aging. The franchise is aging. And we do have to get new people into Star Trek again. And, you know, I've actually talked to a number of people on Twitter who are big TOS fans now, but they weren't TOS fans before the JJ movie came out. They went, they saw the JJ movie, they loved the JJ movie, then they went back and they started watching old Star Trek, and then they really became Trekkies. So that's the one of the big opportunities that I think this reboot offers us. And if that can also help get people in to the books and the comics and the larger Star Trek universe, then I think that, you know, what they're doing right now, what JJ's doing right now, is really good for the health of the franchise that we, you know, we hope will always be around.
Well, and, you know, as Larry Nemechek has said on the Ready Room many times, friend of the show, friend of the site, Star Trek has been kind of reinvented every time it's been on the air for the generation that it's trying to reach. And right now, that reinvention is the JJ verse, and it looks very much like this generation. And so I think we can both agree that we do hope that this movie has a little bit more substance and heart to it. But I'm appreciative to JJ for bringing Star Trek back into the limelight. And making it something big and exciting and huge. And if it gets people again into these books and into the comics and into the larger Star Trek universe, you know, I can't thank him enough.
I think it's doing a good job so far, so hopefully it will keep up. And going back to the Prime universe for just a moment, you and I have been reading the Hive series from Brennan Braga about Locutus and the Borg Queen and, like, I don't know, Spider 7, all kinds of crazy stuff going on with the Borg here. we've been waiting for Hive number 3 to come out, which was supposed to have been out a couple weeks ago, and it wasn't. And now we finally know why that is.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, here in the States, had a bit of a issue with some of our docks on the West Coast having a strike, and that actually gave us the delay for the comics, because they were being shipped from overseas to us. And so now it looks as now that that's been resolved, the Hive number 3 will be coming out December 19th. So I'm very excited to see what will happen, because I've been kind of waiting at the edge of my seat, really left with a cliffhanger at the end of the last issue. And so I'll be very glad to see what happens.
This is why IDW needs to use transwarp conduits to get their comics from the printer overseas into the comic shops in America.
Yes, I was thinking that, or it would just be great if somebody would please, oh, somebody invent transporter technology so we don't have to worry about this anymore, or just create a stable wormhole from one side of the planet to the other.
Any of those would work. However, yeah,
just take your pick.
Get it to us so we can find out what is going to happen next.
I need to know what's going to happen to Poseidon Locutus.
Don't we all?
Today, we're very excited to have Keith DeCandido with us.
Hello!
So glad that you could join us. I'm really glad that you reached out and asked to be on the show. We're glad to have you.
Well, you know, I'm so shy and retiring, so, you know, I very rarely speak in public, and I'm lying through my teeth right now.
Yeah, you've been completely quiet while we've been waiting. We were wondering if you were going to actually speak on the show or not.
But no, I it sounds like a really cool thing you guys are doing here, and as a podcaster myself, I appreciate the value of it. And, you know, I'd love a chance to talk about, you know, my past work and my upcoming work and stuff. So.
Yeah, we're excited about that. Well, on that note, I was going to ask you just what has been your experience with Star Trek? You know, what made you a fan? What got you into it?
I have been a Star Trek fan since birth, or earlier if my mother is to be believed. So I was born in 1969, so that was during the third season of the original series, and my parents were avid viewers of it while it was on the air, and I always watched it. I mean, I don't remember a time when I wasn't watching it. When I was old enough to remember, in the 70s, I grew up in New York City, still live here, and one of the local stations, Channel 11, showed Star Trek every weeknight at 6 o'clock, and that was appointment viewing for me and my parents when I was growing up. You know, we would watch Star Trek and then we'd go have dinner. that was the nightly routine. So that was, I grew up with it. It was always, and I always enjoyed it. I remember some traumatic experiences, specifically the salt vampire from the Man Trap, always scared the crap out of me. as well as the big green fat guy from In the Children Shall Eat.
Well, he scared everyone.
And it was years before I could watch The Man Trap again. I'd never bothered to watch In the Children Shall Eat again because, you know, why?
Exactly.
it also explains the lack of salt vampires and big green fat guys in my fiction. But
well, I mean, I don't think they're any worse for not having them
probably
in the books. So yeah.
But I always like the characters. I was particularly fond of McCoy and Sulu. They were always my two favorite. But and I got the James Blish books when I was a kid as well.
Okay. Yeah.
And loved those. And it was always a part of, you know, my what I watched and what I listened to and what I read. And I also started reading Star Trek novels and comic books. I read DC's comic that they put out in the 80s that Mike Barr and Tom Sutton did. Bought that every month. I was a huge novel reader. And I always wanted to be one of the guys who wrote those. So it was kind of cool that actually, you know, happened.
Yeah, how did that come about? Did you always know you wanted to be an author?
Oh, pretty much. There were brief dalliances when I was very small of wanting to be an actor or a lawyer. The lawyer one was very, very brief. No pun intended. And the actor thing never really came together. I always liked writing. I had a typewriter from when I was a little kid. I wrote a couple of entire novels when I was very young, which have been lost to the ages, for which the ages are grateful. And I wrote a really bad Star Trek novel in high school.
What was it about?
It was a Captain Sulu novel, because I always thought Sulu should have his own command, and it was horrible. Really, really horrible.
And just question now, a Captain Sulu novel, in what year did you write
that? I wrote it in 83, 84. I based it on Vonda McIntyre's novelization of Wrath of Khan, which was based on the original script, which had Sulu was supposed to go off and have his own command.
Right.
And and then and also her, you know, her explanation in the novelization of Star Trek III as to why he didn't get it. Okay. And I was using that as the basis, and then they basically it took place somewhere in the movie continuity. It was I wrote it in. Yeah, it was in high school, so it would have been before 86. So I, you know, Star Trek IV hadn't come out yet, but I sort of assumed that they would all eventually wind up back in Starfleet and everything would be well and good again. Like I said, Sulu was always one of my favorite characters. So,
oh, that's really cool.
And one of the joys of actually being, you know, professionally involved with Star Trek as a grown-up is that I've gotten to meet a lot of these people. In fact, I got to be one of George Takei's backup singers.
Oh, nice.
This was at the Shoreleaf Convention a bunch of years ago. Robert Greenberger, Peter David, and Michael Jan Friedman have a regular thing they do at Shoreleaf every year that they've been doing for, God, 20 years now, called Mystery Trekkie Theater 3000.
Oh, nice.
And it's exactly what it sounds like. They do an opening sketch. They have a mad scientist, which is T. Allen Chafin. And they do an opening skit, and then they sit in front of a projecting screen with their silhouettes on the bottom, and they do commentary on an episode of Star Trek. You know, and there have been a couple of years where one of the guys, or in one year, two of the guys couldn't make it, and so I've been their fill-in, and there was one year Mike couldn't do it, so I filled in for Mike. And George was the big guest at Shore Leave that year, and his Q&A was right before Mystery Trekkie Theater. Peter and George are old friends. Peter co-wrote George's autobiography back in the day, and they've remained friends. And we did a thing where we ran up to him after his Q&A was done, the three of us. And we did a whole opening thing. This was right after the short-lived reality show, which was people doing things other than what they're famous for. And George was on it, and he was singing country music.
Oh, great.
This reality show was so immensely successful, it didn't make it to a second episode. and this had just happened a few months earlier when we did this. And so we went up to him and said, we'd like you to be in the opening skit. And George was, well, I don't know. And we said, oh, come on, it'll be great. Well, I'm not sure I want to be seen on stage with you guys. He said, well, it's okay. We'll let you pick the bit. We've provided a list, and we hand him a list, and he goes down the list. No. 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 Oh my. No. And then and he keeps going, and he rejects all of them. And I said, what do you want to do? And he says, well, I never got to do what I planned for the second episode of the reality show. And he breaks into Patsy Cline's Seven Lonely Days, and me, Peter, and Bob are his backup singers. So we're dancing in the background and doing all that. It's on YouTube. If you search for George Takei and Keith Candido on YouTube, it's the only hit you'll get.
I was going to ask if there's a video of this.
Yeah, we're going to have to try and put that in the show notes.
Depressingly, there isn't the opening bit, the talking bit. It's just the Patsy Cline song.
Yeah.
With me and two middle-aged Jewish guys from Long Island dancing on background. It was it was pretty entertaining. And this was all Peter. He was the one who came up with the skit. And it was great because we did it right after George's Q&A, so we didn't give them an opportunity to get up and leave. So we had one of the best crowds we ever had for Mystery Trekkie Theater.
That's awesome. All because of George Takei.
Yes. Yes.
That's awesome. Well, you know, they did, this is not one of the questions I had, but, you know, they did write, you know, we did get that Sulu novel not too long ago, about a couple years ago, Forged in Fire. How did you not get to write that? I mean, you're a huge Sulu fan, and you've been wanting to write this since, you know, 86.
Yeah, by then, I had other things in the hopper, and Andy and Mike had already done a Sulu novel for the Lost Era series. They're also big Sulu fans, and it made sense for them to do it because they were working with characters that they'd already established in...
Yeah. That's true.
In their Lost Era novel. And I was doing something else with the Lost Era anyway. I mean, I would have liked... If I had done that for the Lost Era, that would have been cool, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I'm not sorry about that at all, because, honestly, I think The Art of the Impossible is one of the stronger books I've written. It's one I'm particularly proud of. So I certainly have no regrets about working on that. And like I said, it made sense for Andy and Mike to be the ones to do Forged in Fire.
Well, and
even though I'm not only a big Sulu fan, but I'm also, you know, one of the go-to guys for, I was at least one of the go-to guys for the Klingons.
Yes, you were.
But it was cool, and I liked what they came up with as the solution to the problem of how the Klingons got their grooves back, as it were.
Yes, that was a good story. I really liked that story, actually.
Yeah, and I actually I was hired. I did this every once in a while. I would be hired to do sort of a continuity read on things, just to make sure everything held together. Mm-hmm. And in particular, Marco wanted to make sure all the Klingon details were right, since I was more immersed in that, you know. But so I got to read it ahead of time, and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah, it was a great book. It's one of their best books. Yeah. So
I did get to write Kangkor and Koloth in the Seven Deadly Sins anthology. So
yes, you did. Well, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your work with the Klingons. What did you love about getting to explore Klingon culture, and what did you love about getting to add to Klingon culture?
All of it. It was my interest in Klingons started when I was a little kid watching Channel 11, and specifically I blame Michael Ancera, because Day of the Dove was one of my favorite episodes as a kid because I thought Kang was awesome.
Yes.
I loved Kang. I loved his voice. I loved the fact that he was basically the Klingon equivalent of Kirk, and he was on the same level as Kirk.
Right.
Kor was a good adversary, but he wasn't really, I mean, technically he was a fellow ship captain, but Kirk didn't deal with him on those terms. He dealt with him as you know, a revolutionary on the planet, you know, as a planetary governor more than a captain. Kang was Kirk's equal and opposite, and he was completely worthy of it. If you're going to have a character like that, he has to be somebody who you believe can also command a group of people as well as Kirk can, and he did.
Yes. Yes.
And I really liked that. And I don't know what it was. There's something about the Klingon culture just always interested me. And Worf was my favorite character on Next Gen. I loved what they did with him. I loved the way the culture was developed into this sort of Viking samurai thing that Ron Moore and the rest of them developed on Next Gen and then later on DS9 and Voyager. And it's something that I really enjoyed playing with. And getting to flesh out, particularly in things like Art of the Impossible and A Burning House, where I really got into the nitty-gritty of the entire culture. I mean, we really only saw the military and the government, and since it's a military dictatorship, the military and the government are the same thing. So we didn't get a good sense of the rest of Klingon life, and I thought there was good stuff to be explored there, and how that culture, you know, survives as a spacefaring empire. So.
Well, that's something I'd like to ask you, too. What did you think, then, of how Enterprise dealt with, you know, the head ridges? And then, of course, they did give us a little peek into Klingon life that wasn't the military, with having the lawyer who is representing Archer kind of giving us a whole other side.
That's exactly what I was about to ask you, too, was about Enterprise and the Klingons, too. Because we do, even in Broken Bow, we get that kind of glimpse into the chamber.
Yeah.
And you kind of get that feeling of the Klingons as they might have been, say, 100 years, or in the case of what we know primarily of Klingons, which is the Next Generation DS9 period, a couple of 100 years earlier. And so, I'm curious how you thought all that played out in Enterprise, or what might you have done differently with them as well?
I have lots of problems with Enterprise, but their portrayal of Klingons wasn't one of them. I thought they did fine with it. I love Judgment. It's one of my favorite episodes. I mean, leaving aside the fact that I'd be happy to listen to J.G. Hertzler and John Vickery read the phone book, much less, you know, play lawyers. that was a coup of excellent casting. I actually always thought Judgment was amusing because that story would work with any generic human as the person being defended, and which is handy because you won't have a much more generic human than Jonathan Archer. Not a big fan of Enterprise, sorry.
It's okay.
But I liked what that, you know, I liked the way that story in general, in particular, and the show in general, I think did right by the Klingons. To my mind, a lot of, the two-parter in the fourth season where they established the smooth-headedness, while clever, was a lot of explanation for something that didn't really require one. I really felt that Trials and Tribulations handled it just fine, thanks.
I like the way they handled it.
Yeah, you know, we don't talk about it. Okay.
Sometimes you don't need to over-explain something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, and I also thought that the Enterprise portions of that storyline didn't really do anything. I didn't think that was particularly strong. The stuff with Phlox at the base was compelling, and I liked the way they tied it to the augments. I thought that was clever.
Yeah.
But it was... In general, I liked what Enterprise did in the fourth season by doing two and three-parters because it gave them a little more storytelling space. Yes. In this case, they didn't need it. I honestly think that would have worked better as a one-hour story that just focused on Phlox and kept the rest of the crew down to minimal appearances. I mean, they've done that before.
Yeah.
You know, with focusing on one particular character. I think that would have been better as a Phlox-focused episode.
And he was... I mean, honestly, he's one of the best characters on that show. And there's no reason that John Billingsley couldn't completely take an episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to kind of ask you about, because you've written some of my favorite books in the series, and one of them was when you wrapped up the A Time To series. And you kind of had a tall order because there was so much going on. In fact, I was reading the summary of that book on Memory Alpha because it's our Memory Beta. It's been a while since I've read it. But I was remembering, oh my gosh, there was so much going on in this series. How in the world did you wrap that up and make it tie into what was going to happen into Nemesis? And to me, make that seem to work seamlessly.
The mirrors, I guess. It was a lot of work, and one of the reasons why it did work was because it was very much a collaborative effort. That series actually started with John Ordover, and he didn't actually see much of the series through to completion because he left Pocket right when the series was starting up. But it was his conception, and it actually started with me, John, Bob Greenberger, and John Vornholt in a Chinese restaurant in Brooklyn, basically hashing out what we wanted to accomplish here. It was originally supposed to be a 12-book series. It wound up being only 9.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were thinking of it as a one-year thing, you know? And it was intended to be the year leading up to Nemesis. The whole objective of the series was to, A, set up Nemesis, and, B, set up post-Nemesis fiction.
Right.
You know, because we knew that this was, you know, at that point, Nemesis were already out at that point, and you know, this is in 2003 that we were doing this, and at that point it was pretty obvious that there wasn't going to be any more done with the Next Gen crew, so we were given carte blanche to do what we wanted. Plus, at first it was in 2002. That's right, it was in 2002 that we started doing it, because before the movie came out, we were thinking of having. We thought Wesley was going to have a bigger role in the storyline, so he was going to have a bigger role in the overall series.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The idea was that we were going to have him not be a traveler anymore. When his cameo was reduced to him just sitting at the table, we decided to keep him as a traveler because I always thought that was a really big step backward for the character anyway. We all did.
Right.
You know, since the actual dialogue that established him as going over to the Titan with Riker was cut from the final film, we were then no longer beholden to it. You know, the thing about cut scenes, it's like you can include them if you want to, but you're only obligated to be consistent with what's actually part of the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, cut scenes are fair game, but not, you know, you don't have to if you don't want to, and we didn't want to. So, we didn't include, you know, there was a whole thing with Wesley that wound up getting dropped. We did include, simply because it made for an interesting storyline, and it wasn't inconsistent with anything in the movie, we kept the notion that Beverly was offered the job of going to Starfleet Medical.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
That was the case, that was something we thought we could do with, was sort of, you know, play around with the character and where she's going with her career.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, that we wanted to, and of course the real obvious things were, why was Worf back in Starfleet? And why did Riker now finally, after 15 years, accept a command after rejecting three of them? And what led to Riker and Troy deciding to finally get married? And so those were some of the bigger arcs. Plus, we wanted to do something that had the had the Enterprise in a bit of disgrace, just because we wanted to see have them be disgraced in the opening duology and then have them work their way back to that. So those were all the things we wanted to cover. I immediately, when we started planning this, laid claim to the Worf comes back to Starfleet story. Partly because I'm the one who had written the most stories of Worf as an ambassador, which right. I thought was a great development for the character. Having said that, ambassadorial positions are not generally permanent. They're usually temporary. They're not. It's not something you spend your career being an ambassador to a particular place as a general rule. So having him come back, you know, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized that what I had actually Worf say in the book, which was that, you know, everything he did because other people asked him to do it or because other people needed him to do it. And it was long past time that Worf did something for himself, because he has been the most unselfish person around. And he's had a lot of crap thrown at him, and he's taken it, and he's sometimes wallowed in it just for the greater good, and has been willing to sacrifice a great deal for the greater good. And it was about time he did something that he did. Basically, it's like, I wanna. And Dave gave me the easy option because he had, in his duology leading up to it, he had a changeover of presidential administrations.
Right.
So that worked out nicely. The other reason why everything tied together nicely was because we were all working together very closely, particularly me, Bob, and Dave. The last five books, were fairly tight because Bob, Dave, and I are all friends. At the time, we were all having lunch together every week. Bob was working in Manhattan. Dave and I both live in New York City. Mm-hmm. So we would get together and just, you know, throw things back and forth at each other and you know, make sure we were being consistent and all sorts of stuff. One of my favorite things in the whole thing, we actually planned this at one of the lunch gatherings. There was one security guard in Bob's A Time to Love and A Time to Hate. He was the one assigned to protect Picard. And he actually survived throughout the whole thing, which cannot be said for all the other security people, but he made it through.
Yeah.
And he had the hardest job. You know, he had to protect the captain. That was his job. And he, you know, he was in a lot of danger throughout that entire duology, but he made it through alive in the end. And then in A Time to Heal, I think, he was having lunch with some other people in the building below up, and he died. And we thought that was just the perfect security guard death right there. You know, just have this guy, we get to know him, we like him, he survived, you're grateful he survived, and then we drop a building on him. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're going to go, that's the way to go.
Exactly. So we just did that to be mean, and we like pulling stuff like that. You know, because we're as writers, we are cold-hearted people. And we don't feel our characters are really done until we've really, really abused them properly. But but also, one of the things I wanted to do with A Time for War, A Time for Peace was kind of do a proper ending for Next Gen that still left it open for other stuff. Kind of be the finale that Nemesis didn't entirely work at being.
Yeah,
exactly. It did partly, but and I like the fact that they finally had everybody moving on. That was something that bugged me about the original series movies and about the Next Gen movies, was that you got characters who really should have gone on with their lives. They're in the same positions that they were, you know, for 15 years, and it's ridiculous.
Well, you get to the point on the original series movies, we joke about this sometimes, like everyone's a captain at some point.
Yeah!
Right?
It's ridiculous.
It's like, Captain Sulu, could you set course? I can't do it right now. Get Captain Chekhov to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think Captain Spock would be better at running those numbers for us.
Is Uhura a captain yet?
But yeah, right. I mean, by the time Star Trek V rolled around, all of these guys should have at the very least been first officer somewhere, if not commanding their own ships. It's just silly. And, you know, Riker should have, honestly, to my mind, if I was in charge, Riker would have had his own ship in First Contact. That also, like the Defiant, got the crap kicked out of it, and basically having sort of a reunion on the Enterprise where, you know, Riker and Worf, maybe, I don't know, LaForge or Troy, you know, are rescued and brought on board. And then they have to all go back in time together. You know, just establish that some of these guys have actually gone on to other things.
Yeah.
And Nemesis at least addressed that finally, you know, with the idea that I mean, in the original draft, that Crusher was going to go off to head up Starfleet Medical, that and Riker and Troy going off to Titan, which was a long overdue development. And I wanted the wedding, the Riker Troy wedding to be, have that little speech that Riker gives before the wedding starts, was something that I thought was important to sort of, you know, bring everything full circle for Next Gen as a franchise, you know, as a thing. You know, and it was the last time this crew was all going to be together.
Yeah. And I liked that because it gave a lot of closure. You know, Nemesis kind of came and I think it slapped a lot of us in the face. We weren't ready for what happened there. And then, of course, we didn't get any more. And so, you know, it had been 4 years. We had waited a long time. You know, we had hoped that the next movie was going to be better than Insurrection, and it wasn't, and then it was a letdown because there wasn't anything else. So what I really did like about the whole A Time to series is that it helped me appreciate the good parts of Nemesis, and then made me excited to continue on in the series of novels, because I was going to continue to see my favorite characters in a new and different light. And, you know, of all the characters, I mean, I'm reading David Mack's new series right now, and the way that Picard has changed over the last few years in the novels is incredible. And it really, I think, started with A Time Too, and you guys making him realize that the mortality that he's facing, he's not going to live forever. He wants to do something else with his life, and it's not just be a starship captain. There's more important things out there like family. And so I think that kind of thing that you guys gave to us as fans was wonderful, because it's the kind of thing that we loved when Deep Space Nine ended. I didn't feel sad. I felt only sad because I wasn't going to be with my friends every week. I felt completed when that series ended.
Yeah. Although I was, and we addressed this in the fiction also, my only frustration with DS9's finale was that it should have ended with Bajor joining the Federation. That was Sisko's mission from the first episode, and if you really wanted to bring it if you really want to bring it full circle, that's where, you know, I wish the end of the war hadn't been the end of the series. I think that they should have ended the war like for February sweeps, you know, and then done some aftermath episodes that ended with the finale. You know, hell, save all the Fire Cave stuff and all the rest of it for the end. And then end it with Bajor formally joining the Federation, even if you still have Sisko going off to be one with the Prophets at the end. You know, that was my only frustration with DS9's finale. But yes, in general, What You Leave Behind was a much stronger ending, you know. Yeah. Hell, even Endgame, for all its flaws, was a good end. You know, it ended the show really the way it kind of had to, in the case of Voyager, you know, just bringing it, you know, getting them home. Although, again, that's another one where I would have liked to have seen then what happened, you know? But
yeah. Well, luckily, there's been some fantastic books in the Voyager series. So we talked to Kirsten last week, and fantastic. Her novels are some of my favorites in the series now. So
Kirsten's done a great job with that. I'm glad she got stewardship of it. It was always a problem with Voyager. You know, it's relatively easy to continue all the other series because, you know, I mean, DS9's still there at the wormhole. You know, the Enterprise is still exploring space. Both, you know, Kirk's Enterprise, Picard's Enterprise, and Archer's Enterprise are still, after their series are over, are still out there seeking, you know, exploring strange new worlds and whatnot. DS9 is still the gateway to the Gamma Quadrant. Voyager, they came home. Now what?
Yep. You know?
And it was hard to work something out. And I like the solution they came up with, especially once we started dealing with Slipstream Drive, which made it a little more practical. You know, because you didn't want to do a return to Gilligan's Island thing where they get, oh my God, they're stranded again. You know.
This is the dumbest crew ever.
Yeah, right.
And Harry's still an ensign through all of it, right?
Yeah. Chakotay still only talks about one thing. It's being an Indian.
But I like the solution they came up with is have it be a planned exploration, a re-exploration, really. And I think that, and Kirsten's, you know, perfect person to do it. It's funny. I have written 3-4 Voyager stories. And none of them take place in the Delta Quadrant. Three. I did the Mirror Universe Voyager story,
yep.
which had it had a brief scene in the Delta Quadrant, but it had Kes and Neelix coming to the Alpha Quadrant and getting rescued by a rebel cell led by Chakotay. So it was Voyager in reverse. But basically, almost nothing in the Delta Quadrant there. When I used them in the Brave and the Bold duology, it took place before Caretaker. So mm-hmm. it was before that happened. And the short story I did for Distant Shores, which is one of my favorite stories that, that I've done, was Letting Go, which was all about the people that got left behind. It was And I had... That was something... I mean, it wasn't something Voyager was in a position to address because it was focused on the ship itself. But I kept wondering... And they touched on it periodically, like when Janeway got the Dear Kathy letter from her boyfriend that Mark
right.
moved on, when they finally got in touch. And like my thought was, okay, you know, what were they going through? What were, you know, Harry's parents and Tuvok's wife and kids and Janeway's boyfriend and the rest of them? What were, you know, they knew that the ship was lost, but they didn't know what happened to it. And what were they going through? It was inspired at least partly by an old MASH episode called The Party, where BJ basically organized a get-together for everybody's, you know, like Potter's mm-hmm. wife and Hawkeye's father and his and BJ's wife and Houlihan's parents and Mulcahy's sister and all the rest of them all to get together and have a little party in New York. And that was what inspired the gatherings that happened in Letting Go. Including the families of the people who died in the first hour. One of the things I've tried to do is actually... one of the things that bugged me about the first episode of Voyager was when they fall down the rabbit hole into the Delta Quadrant, the first officer, the chief medical officer, the head nurse, the ship's pilot, and the chief engineer are all killed.
Yes.
By the second hour of Caretaker, everybody seems to have forgotten they even exist.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's Voyager.
Well, imagine a Next Generation episode in which Riker, LaForge, Ro, Crusher, and Ogawa are all killed. It would come up in conversation occasionally.
Right, exactly.
It would be noted. Poor Cavett and Stotty. And I love Stotty. Stotty was cool. It was Alicia Coppola, you know. And the medical officer and the chief engineer didn't even get names, you know. I named them in Brave and the Bold. And but the I always thought that was that always bugged me, you know, that these people were all basically died. But I'm sorry, it's four stories because technically, in addition to those three, I also did an alternate. Reality story in the Myriad Universes series, which actually
that's right.
I deliberately touched on all the. I wasn't able to work Enterprise into it, but the others were. I used Scotty in order to have a TOS hit, but involved what would have been TNG, DS9, and Voyager. Except, of course, in this timeline, neither DS9 nor Voyager would have happened because the Cardassians never pulled out of Bajor.
Oh yeah.
Also, the border disputes never happened, so the Maquis were never formed, so Voyager never went to the Delta Quadrant. So, but I did do a scene with the USS Voyager with what should have been their actual crew, you know, of Cavett and Stavi mm-hmm. and Tuvok and Kim and them. And then they get blown up. But that doesn't make them unusual in that story, as the death count in the death count in A Gutted World was something fierce. I got my Dave Mack on as I joked at the time.
Yeah, he does like to kill people.
He does. Yes.
Like I don't want to say who he killed in this newest series, but oh my gosh, it was pretty shocking. So I'll be interested to see how it plays out, but wow.
The advantage of doing fiction where you're no longer tied to you're no longer obligated to follow actor availability.
Mhm.
One of the fun things about the Lost Era series was that there's no way to tell stories in that era unless you recast everybody because, you know, it's everybody's either too old or too young
right.
To play those roles. And so, you know, because it's in that in-between time and you don't have to worry, you know, you can have a novel in which, you know, Sarek and Sulu and Uhura and you know, a young Curzon Dax and whatnot all appear.
Right.
And with the post-finale fiction, which is pretty much all of them at this point, aside from the original series, all of them, because you're freed up, you're not dealing with actor contracts and you're not dealing with availability and whatnot, you can use whatever characters you want and do whatever you want to them. And there can be consequences, which often will make for better stories. Not that you can't tell good stories when you have to put everything back in the sandbox, but it's nice to have the additional tool occasionally.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it makes it gives it a little bit more realism without, you know, just destroying the fact that, you know, we come here to Star Trek land to be entertained as much as we do to learn something. So,
and you don't want to make that kind of decision lightly. I mean, one of the, I was the editor of the Starfleet Corps of Engineers series that was run as an ebook series from 2000 to 2007. And we had one story written by Dave Mack, in which we killed off half the crew, including one of the main characters. And that was, that wasn't something we did lightly, but it also wasn't something I wanted. There were a couple of things we wanted to accomplish there. One was to really, you know, have a death that would be meaningful. I mean, we killed off a lot of other characters. There were secondary characters who only had small roles and wouldn't have the same emotional impact as killing Duffy did. And I also wanted there to be consequences. The all those deaths on the ship continued to have ramifications throughout the entire rest of the series because it would, you know.
Exactly.
You know, it lessened as time went on because things do, but it was always a presence in the storyline. And I also, for once in Star Trek, I wanted somebody to go on a suicide mission and actually die.
Yeah.
I thought that was important. You know. And Dave actually had an out. He was willing to, you know, give us an out and have him get saved at the last minute, and and I double checked, you know, I was the main editor, but John Ordover, I was freelance, so John Ordover was the in-house editor and was sort of the editor emeritus of the series, especially in the early days. And, you know, we John and I talked about it, and it's like, nah, kill him.
That's great.
Let's have these actions have consequences. Space is a dangerous place. Let's let it be dangerous.
Space is disease and danger wrapped in darkness and silence.
Exactly. Which was a great line, and it's true.
It is.
Yeah.
Don't go pandering to me, boy.
Yeah. But that was one of the great things about the Abrams film was I've been a fan of Carl Urban since he played Cupid on Hercules and Julius Caesar on Xena back in the 90s.
Yeah, he's great.
And he's really good. I'm really glad his career has taken off because he impressed me then, and I actually got to meet him at a few Herc and Xena conventions back in the day.
Nice.
And he's just an absolute sweetheart. And it was just I love seeing him be successful because he frankly deserves it.
He's my favorite character in the new JJ verse.
Oh yeah,
I mean his bones is fantastic.
Yeah.
So
and it fits because McCoy was always my favorite.
Yeah. Well, and he brings McCoy to life, and I'm really hoping that they give him a little bit more of a juicier role in the new one. So
the thing I was most concerned about with the Abrams film, more than anything else, going just before we knew anything about it, just that they were doing it, was one of the reasons why the original series was successful was the absolute letter-perfect chemistry among William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly.
Yes.
And I was really worried that they were not going to catch that lightning in a bottle again. Luckily, I at least thought that Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, and Carl Urban did a fine job, and they actually, they worked as the big three, and that was always the worry there.
Well, and for me, this is completely off-topic, obviously, but Pine definitely, I think, captured Shatner without mimicking Shatner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many scenes where you're like, wow, that's Captain Kirk on the screen. Well, one of the things that you did in the novels, which I thought was incredible, is you took politics and you actually made it riveting to the point where Articles of the Federation is one of the books that I would hold up there of Star Trek literature to say, this is awesome.
Thank you.
How in the world did you take, you know, politics and make it interesting?
The thing that interests me most is dialogue anyway and the conversations people have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part of the writing I enjoy the most. And so that, you know, it was a natural outgrowth of that. I mean, that originally came about several years before it actually happened. Both John Ordover and his boss at the time, Scott Shannon, who was the publisher for a while, they came to me and they said, you know, we want to do a Star Trek version of the West Wing, basically. That was the pitch. And yes, there is quite a bit of Jed Bartlett in Nanbako. I freely admit that. Nanbako is actually a combination of Jed Bartlett, Molly Ivins, the columnist who died a few years ago, Ann Richards, the former Texas governor, and my great grandmother.
Nice.
She's named after my great grandmother, and she died in 2003. And I created Bako for A Time for a Time for Peace as much as a tribute to her as anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thrilled that the character has continued to live. I honestly didn't think we'd ever see her again after Articles, you know, unless by some miracle I was asked to write a sequel, which the sales figures proved was never going to happen, because the book did not do particularly well. But it was very well reviewed and very well received. It's probably the most praised novel certainly the most praised Star Trek novel I've written. But it didn't sell particularly well, because I think the people who bought it liked it, but not a lot of people came to the table in the first place, because it was a very unusual book.
Yes.
And in retrospect, I kind of wish we'd put Spock on the cover.
Just on the cover.
You know, well, he's in the book. It's not like, you know, he would be lying. He plays a role in the book. And writing Spock as a, and I really enjoyed writing Spock as a cranky old man. You know, that was...
Yeah, he's a lot of fun.
But anyway, with you know, like I said, Articles came out of the idea of they wanted me to do a Star Trek version of the West Wing, and then it never really came together, and then we started developing a time to. And it was actually partly because Dave was doing, having, you know, basically the fall of a president as part of his story.
Right.
And we figured, all right, if we're going to do that, let's have, you know, I can do the election, and then I can set up me finally doing this West Wing idea you guys wanted me to do for a while. In fact, there was original thought of having A Time for War, Time for Peace be two books, and a lot of the stuff that wound up being in Articles would have been part of that two-book series instead.
Oh, okay.
In retrospect, in hindsight, I'm glad we did it this way.
Yeah, I am too.
I think Time for War, Time for Peace worked better as a single novel to bring it all together, even though it basically cost me a novel contract. Everybody else got, like, the advance for two books. I got the advance for one book. It's like, hey! but it worked, yeah, story-wise, it worked better.
It did.
I was glad to do Articles as its own book. And, you know, the thing is, politics actually work fairly well with Star Trek, because Star Trek at its best has, you know, a philosophical underpinning that can work very well. You know, the idea of doing, you know, politics, it's a good parts version of politics in a lot of ways, because the Federation is a very ideal and very unrealistic and probably impossible society. But that's part of what makes it compelling as fiction, the idea of how politics would work in an ideal utopian society.
Yeah.
And I also, we wanted to, like, look at, you know, how does it work from the other side of it? What does the government do?
Mm-hmm.
How do they get things done? And one of the things in particular, Marco Palmieri was the one who edited the project, even though it was originally pitched to me by John. By the time I did it, John had left, and so Marco took it over. And one of the things Marco specifically wanted in the book was a first contact situation. He wanted to show what happens after the first contact. Once the Starfleet ship shows up, they say hello, they exchange scientific information, they trade phone numbers, whatever it is they do when they do first contact. Then what happens?
I'll have my people get in touch with your people.
Right. And the thing is there, what happens after that? What is the process? What, you know, at that point you're starting to get ambassadors and politicians and such involved. And what do they do after the Starfleet ship is buggered off to seek out another new life and new civilization? You know? So that was part of what we wanted to address there as well. Plus also the fallout from Nemesis.
Right.
You had the entire Romulan Senate turned to pixie dust. And then the guy who turned them into pixie dust took over and then got killed. So you've got this massive power vacuum. in one of the three major powers of the sector. You know, that's going to have repercussions. And I wanted to deal with that as well. So, and that actually led to the idea of the schism between splitting the Romulan Empire in half was something I thought could be fun to deal with, and it was for a while. But the challenge there was, and I'm glad that it worked for most people, because Articles of the Federation is almost entirely people sitting in rooms talking to each other, and that's it. In order to make that work, you've got to have interesting characters, and some of them were ones that were already established. You know, Admiral Akaar and Admiral Ross and Spock, obviously.
Wait, you didn't create that Spock character? Because he was really good.
I had good material on that one.
I like him.
Yeah, Spock was one of the most fun things I ever wrote was in the Brave and the Bold book 2, where I had Spock and Worf mind melding.
Oh gosh.
And it's interesting because the two of them have a lot of similarities in their lives and development and whatnot, a lot more than you realize. And you know, mashing them together like that was just some of the most fun I've ever had writing anything. And also writing aged Spock and aged McCoy snarking at each other. I mean, I was not the first to do that, obviously. I think Peter David did a particularly nice job with that in the Medalla Imperative comic book. But getting to write them just snarking at each other, you know, falling into the same old patterns, you know, that they've been doing for 100 years now, was tremendous fun also. But anyway, jumping back to Articles, you know, some of the characters were already established. I also used a couple of Federation counselors who were established either by myself or by others in other books and brought them all in. The Bajoran counselor was General Krim, Stephen Mock's character from the Circle trilogy. That was actually something Marco did. Although I was one of the people. I along with some other people, helped him develop that. Both Marco and I were huge fans of the Krim character, and I always wanted to see more done with him. And so Marco came up with the idea of, hey, let's make him Bajor's new counselor now that they've joined the Federation. Ran with that because I really wanted to have. I love the idea of having Krim play a big role in this, which he did. And I was using the Circle trilogy as his the basis for how to do his character. So it was, like I said, it was at least partly dealing with established characters and also creating some of my own to fill it out, and hopefully coming up with a bunch of different people who could create, you know, an interesting dynamic of people trying to run the Federation. So
yeah, well, and because honestly, anytime Nan comes up in any book after this, I love her scenes. And I think part of what I like about her is what you were talking about with this idea of, you know, you have this utopian society, how do you run it? Well, apparently it runs best when you have a pessimistic, cranky old woman doing it, because she's just pessimistic enough to be able to, I really picture, she's a lot like Sisko, I feel like, in A Pale Moonlight. She's not afraid to get her hands dirty.
Although that was totally not what she signed up for.
Right, exactly.
And I love the way Dave wrote her in the Destiny trilogy in particular. And he ran all that by me, which he didn't. He was under no obligation to do, but because you know, we none of us own this stuff. So and he certainly had no obligation to show him to me, but he did anyway because he wanted to make sure. He did right by the character because he was the first person to write her besides me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad he did because she works perfectly.
Yeah, and I love the way he wrote her and the whole... Although it's kind of frustrating because she went to all the trouble to build that coalition and they all got killed in about 3 minutes. Yeah. But still, well, the way she did it, you know, was great. And I love, you know, that was some really well done stuff. And it was true to her character. And, you know, this is somebody who definitely is not doing the job she thought she'd be doing.
Exactly.
When she originally ran for president.
Yeah.
But that's cool. It's a chance to develop. One of the fun things is being able to develop characters. And you know, like you said, what's been done with Picard over the course of the books. Mm-hmm. You know, Worf growing into the role of first officer. You know, and the development that's gone on in the Voyager books for the various characters and how they're dealing with coming home and then going back out again. That's part of the fun is being and. in particular, it's a very collaborative thing because we're all working together. You know what I mentioned before about me, Bob, and Dave working on the A Time 2 series. And for that matter, what all of the writers, I was the editor sort of supervising it, but what all the writers did with the Corps of Engineers series, because we were, the story, the plots were all standalone, but the character arcs were a continuous thing, and with different people taking different things. You know, I love, like, three different writers established different things about the Dr. Lenz, who was the chief medical officer on the Da Vinci. You know, Christy had done some stuff with her, and Christy Golden had done stuff with her in one story. There was another story involving her dealing with a small child who was ill, and then another story in which basically her narcissism came full bore on dealing with a medical crisis. And then Ilsa Bick came and tied all these three threads together into a story she did called Wounds, which ended with her getting pregnant, which caused all sorts of hassle, because that wasn't part of the original story. There was something we had talked about doing, is getting her pregnant maybe at some point down the line, and then she wound up putting it in the story, and my first thought was, crap, we can't do this, we got it. And then I thought about it for a second, it's like, well, wait a minute. And so we ran with it. The problem was, it was a monthly series. That was number 56. Number 57 was already written. William Leisner had turned his story in already, and I said, Bill, I need a rewrite, it's not your fault. but we have to redo this so Lenz is pregnant now. And he said, what? But the funny thing is, it worked. The story was about 100 times better, because what Lenz had to do in Bill's story, her being pregnant made it 15 times more poignant, and it led to a whole bunch of other cool developments we got to do. You know, and all because of the different, you know, different people throwing different ideas back and forth at each other. And that, you know, you still see that going on with, you know, with David and David George and Dave Mack and and Una and the rest, and Christopher, you know, what they've done developing the various and sundry things.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
fun.
It is. And I think it shows in the writing and that the continuity really works. One of the things I thought was really interesting is the fact that you were tasked with writing a book after Death in Winter. And everything was leading up to Destiny, but you got to write about Q. How in the world did you, you know, get them to, well, can we not do a Borg book in here? You know, we're going to have like 20 of them. Can we at least have something else? How did that come about? Because it turned out to be the best one of all of them.
Oh, thank you. They came to me and said, you know, you want to do the, actually it wasn't the follow-up to Death in Winter, it was the follow-up to Resistance.
Yes, Resistance, exactly.
Ginny had already written Resistance, so the idea was I was to do the, it was, you know, they were going to do three books for the 20th anniversary in 2007, and basically I said, you know, we got to do a Q story. It's the 20th anniversary. He was, in the first episode, he was the same. And I had this idea in the back of my head. I hadn't fleshed it out yet, but just the basics of an idea that there was actually a purpose to everything Q did. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to run with that. And it sort of came together better than I thought it was going to. But it was my request to do Q, because I thought that for the 20th anniversary we needed a Q story, and also we needed a break from the Borg. I mean,
yes,
you know,
we
did the Borg in Resistance. The next one was going to be the Borg, and eventually, you know, Christopher did the Borg dealt with, you know, the Hugh end of Borg in Greater Than the Sum. Somewhere in there, we needed something else, and I really pushed for doing Q, you know, basically doing the ultimate Q story. So that really, I mean, it was just basically me saying, "Can I do Q, please? Ha ha! Can I? Ha ha!" No more complicated than that.
I loved it, and I liked what you said, you know, because it was interesting to see that Q had a purpose, you know, and in some ways, you know, him being this kind of like godlike figure, that he's not just, you know, somebody who's out there for just the laughs. He could see the future. He knew what was going to happen, so he engineers everything so that Picard is ready for this final test.
Right. Well, it would explain why I took such an interest in him, particularly in episodes like Tapestry. Even Cupid to some extent, where it seemed like, I mean, Cupid, there was a debt to be fulfilled there, so you could pop that off. But the particularly something like Tapestry and All Good Things. Mm-hmm. There seemed to be there should have been a greater purpose there just based on the way he was behaving. And so I tried to tie it all together. And like I said, I think it worked. And it also gave me a chance to introduce some new characters who then later got written out. But it's been tough populating the Enterprise with new crew.
Yes. It's been hard to keep them straight. Luckily, most of them are been the same for a while now. So, yeah. So,
some characters worked, some didn't. I these things will happen. My particular thing with Katahata was to have somebody who had a family. I wanted to, specifically deal with that.
And I really liked her.
Thank you. One of the things that bugged me about the series was that they came up with this whole idea of there are families on the ship, and none of the main characters really had families. You know, I mean, Crusher had her kid on board, but then she was gone in the second season, and then he was gone after the fourth. You had the O'Brien wedding, which at least went to some extent to address it, but then they went off to Deep Space Nine. Worf had a kid, but that was a disaster on pretty much every level. It's interesting. I've been watching. I've been doing a rewatch of Star Trek: The Next Generation on Tor.com.
Yes, you have.
And one of the things that I am being reminded of is how really, really terrible the Alexander episode.
A lot of people say that.
What's funny is that Brian Bonsall actually was not a bad actor, and he was much better when he wasn't paired up with Michael Dorn. When the two of them got together, all they were doing was shouting at each other.
Yeah.
And there was no, it was just tiresome, just constant shouting back and forth and yelling and screaming and whatnot. Bonsall was much stronger when he was paired up with Luxana Troi or with Deanna Troi for that matter, and in Rascals and Imaginary Friend, where he was with other kids and was just, used as, second kid to the left when they needed other kids around. But it was much easier to deal with under those circumstances. Which is hilarious considering that I was the one who actually made him be the new ambassador.
Yeah. Well, that worked.
I cannot take credit for that. That actually, the idea for that was from Terry Osborne, who has also written a few bits of Star Trek fiction.
Oh, okay.
And she was the one who suggested making Alexander the new ambassador, which I thought was brilliant. It was a perfect, it keeps the whole legacy thing going on there, and it's the perfect thing for him because he's got his feet in both worlds.
Right, exactly.
And he's a terrible soldier. Yeah. And back in Firstborn, it was established that at least in one alternate future, he became a politician. So,
yeah, well, okay, that's one of the things that I wanted to get to, because you haven't written Star Trek in a while.
No.
Man, we want you back. Are you going to, or is there anything in the works?
There's nothing in the works right now aside from the rewatch. Basically, anytime there's an editorial change, there are some writers who the new editorial regime is not as interested in working with, and the current editorial regime is not interested in working with me. This happens. This happens with tie-in fiction all the time. Yeah. Or any kind of fiction. There were when John Ordover left, there were a few authors he liked to work with who suddenly found themselves not doing any more stuff. And it happened again with Marco leaving, and that's what happened with me.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing tie-in fiction, you have to be able to work, when you're an editor, which I have also been quite a bit, you have to be able to work with people who you are comfortable working with, because there's so much other stuff you got to deal with as well. And because it's so strongly controlled by editorial to some extent, because they have to keep track of all the different plot threads going on, the current editors don't want to work with me. And honestly, I respect that decision as somebody who has been on that side of the desk. Mm-hmm. There have been people, who I have been less than comfortable working with, or who I have worked with and regretted it later. And not everybody gets along with everybody else. To give one example from my own career, I had pitched a bunch of Buffy the Vampire Slayer novels back in the late 90s. I had worked on The Watcher's Guide and done a novelization called The Xander Years, and I pitched like 4 or 5 different Buffy novels, and the editor didn't go for any of them, and she finally just said, look, this isn't working. You and I obviously aren't on the same wavelength, and so I, you know, I gave up on that. And then years later, that editor had long since moved on, and I was pitching actually Alias novels to one of the editors over there, and that same editor was responsible for the Buffy line. And one of the proposals that I had pitched way back in the late 90s wound up becoming the novel The Deathless.
Oh.
You know, the ideas don't go bad. And, you know, sometimes you just got to wait for it to come around on the guitar again, as Arlo Guthrie would say. And
yeah, right.
In this case, you know, in the case of the Buffy novel, that old idea finally had somewhere to go because there was an editor who was more receptive to it. So, you know, it may come around on the guitar again. It may not. I don't know.
Okay. No, that's good.
I've got plenty to keep me busy right now.
Good.
It's honestly, this is giving me an opportunity to work on my own stuff that I keep the copyright on, which, as much fun as tie-in fiction is and as much as I enjoy it and as much as I've done of it and I'm continuing to do, I've got a Leverage novel coming out next year. I really want to focus on stuff that is mine, you know. I've got my Precinct series of fantasy police procedurals, which are kind of Law and Order meets Lord of the Rings. I've got 3 books out in that, with 2 more coming out in 2013. I've got my superhero police procedural called SCPD, the Super City Police Department. I've got a series of short stories, urban fantasy short stories in Key West. I've got some comic book work in the works that I can't talk about yet because the contracts aren't signed yet, but you know, I've got stuff to keep me busy, and you know, I'm especially grateful that Tor.com asked me to do the rewatch, because it's allowing me to continue to keep my toes in the Star Trek pool. And the rewatch is fun. I am having so much fun with that.
Yeah, it's a good series. If listeners, if you haven't checked that out, you need to at Tor.com. It's a great rewatch.
Yeah, I'm in the 6th season at this point, so and should still be when the by the time this goes live. But it's been a lot of fun. I mean, parts of it have been less fun than others, like, you know, the entire first season practically. Although there were some gems in there too. There are some episodes of the first season that are actually much better than people give them credit for. Same for the second season.
And you weren't getting to watch them on Blu-ray yet, so.
No, but I don't care about that so much.
Okay.
I mean, you know, most of the time I'm watching it on my laptop anyway, because easier to just, you know, yeah. I don't need to see every single pixel of detail. I just, you know,
yeah.
And the, I'm perfectly happy to just, you know, watch it, whatever format I've got. Of course, I still have all the old VHS tapes from when I recorded it on my VCR back when the show was on the air the first time. P.S. They're in the garage,
too.
And I have nothing to play them on, but I still have the tapes.
Well, I was going to ask you, you know, not writing for Trek novels for a while. What do you see as being where Trek novels are now? Just kind of the state of Star Trek and the novel series.
I haven't been keeping up with them as much, so I'm not really sure what it is. I mean, every once in a while, I'll get a question from somebody who wants to check on something, particularly if it relates to President Bacow or the Klingons, since those are 2 things that I had a big hand in. But I really couldn't say one way or the other. I'm glad to see that the Typhon Pact has become a big thing, because I'm the one who created it, pretty much. Well, me and Marco both. Basically, that was me and Marco having a lunch, and after I got the assignment to do a Singular Destiny and trying to figure out, we were originally going to call it the Covenant, and then it turned out Halo had something called the Covenant, so we couldn't do that.
Yes.
We eventually went with the Typhon Pact, and I'm glad to see that is continuing.
Yeah, it's been a great storyline.
And I only know secondhand what's been going on with Deep Space Nine, but I'm fascinated by the way they've basically jumped forward and shaken things up over there.
Well, they blew it up, so.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that sucks.
Sorry to spoil it for you.
Okay. The thing is that is perfectly in keeping with Deep Space Nine. Change was always the order of the day on DS9. So, you know, it made sense that if you're going to jump ahead a few years, that a lot of things are not going to be in the same place they were.
Yep. Well, I'm looking forward to talking to David, because, you know, a lot of people were disheartened when Rough Beasts of the Empire came out, because it was so, like, Sisko was in this place that we had never even thought he would be. And then, you know, his last two books, he brought it back. So if you read those as a trilogy, it really makes a lot of sense.
Right.
You know, when you're just waiting at Rough Beasts of the Empire and then thinking, okay, are we ever going to get another Deep Space Nine novel again? What's going to go on? But he worked it perfectly, so it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I trust him implicitly. I'm glad that he's going to continue to be working in Deep Space Nine. So.
Yeah, I love David. I've worked with him as an editor really only once on the Captain Sable anthology, where he did a wonderful Demora Sulu story. But he and I have been friends for ages, and we've gone back and forth on stuff. You know, just you know, particularly when I was more active in the franchise. But even since then, every once in a while, just talking about stuff. And
yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, and an excellent writer.
He really is. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking and trying to work out a time for him to be on the show, so I can't wait to get to speak to him. So
don't ask him about the Mets. Seriously, he'll just go on and on and on complaining about everything. Just, you know, he's a Mets fan from way back. I'm a Yankee fan, so you know I just mock him. But
oh man, well you guys have so many sports teams up there to choose from, so it's like you know you just take your pick. Well, one of the things we like to do here is just kind of ask the authors. What they enjoy reading that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Star Trek. What are the things that you might pick up if you peruse the bookstore at the Strand or Barnes & Noble?
My current favorite writer is George Pelicanos, who is a... His books are in the mystery section, but they're not really mysteries. He writes urban dramas. I first actually was introduced to Pelicanos through the HBO show The Wire, where he was one of the staff writers. And then I discovered that he was a novelist who had been brought in mainly because the subject matter he tackles and the subject matter The Wire tackles was very similar. And he just does an amazing job of really creating excellent characters who are middle class or lower. And he just the city of Washington, D.C. is really the only consistent character throughout all his books. In much the same way South Florida is the only consistent character in Carl Hiaasen's books. Some of his books take place like back in the 40s and the 70s and the 80s, contemporary and so on. And, you know, he's got some regular characters who show up periodically, some recurring ones. But he creates a sense of place so incredibly well. And shows a side of humanity in D.C. that you don't see represented very often. And that's something I'm particularly interested in. I also have a tendency to read a lot of baseball books. Baseball is a hobby, although it's becoming a professional thing because I'm actually co-editing a Yankees annual that's going to be published in the spring, which is going to be a collection of essays about the New York Yankees. That's the joy of being a freelancer. You don't have hobbies because even your hobbies become something you wind up working professionally, whether you wanted to or not. You
know. That's me, for sure.
Well, anything that you would like to just share with our listeners about what you're working on and where they can follow you and get in touch with you and all those kind of good things?
You can find me online. My website is decandido.net, my last name, .net. From there, they're ordering links for all my most recent fiction, including the Precinct books that I just mentioned, SCPD, a thriller I did called 30, Vampire Anthology, Shared World Vampire Anthology with Jonathan Mayberry called V-Wars. You can pre-order my Leverage novel. There's also, I did a Farscape comic book for 3 years.
Oh, good show.
Yeah, I worked with Rockne O'Bannon on that. That was post-finale stuff. It was all after the Peacekeeper War, so it was basically season 5 of the show, which we did as a comic book for a bunch of years. And I did a couple of side miniseries with Dargo that took place during the series. And actually, Dave Mack worked with Rockne on an 8-issue Scorpius series that was all part of that.
Oh, very cool. That's great.
Those are available from Boom Studios. And again, there's ordering links at decandido.net. Also from there are links to my blog, my Facebook page, my Twitter feed. If you give me a friend request on Facebook, I'll accept it. I'm fairly open that way. Just search for Keith DeCandido. Not Keith R.A. DeCandido. That's the author page that I have no control over that they just created from my Wikipedia page. So... But again, if you go to decandido.net, there's a link there. That also has a link to the podcast I do, which is a pop culture podcast, and Dead Kitchen Radio, which is my own podcast where I babble about myself. I've already, on past episodes of Dead Kitchen Radio, I've done in-depth talks about the Corps of Engineers series and about the Klingon novels.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we'll definitely want to get people there because those are some of your most popular novels. I know from being on the BBS boards, you know, that I was getting people asking, like, ask Keith this, ask Keith that, you know, so.
I've got two short story collections. One is called Tales from Dragon Precinct, which is based on the fantasy police procedural novel series I did. The first three books, Dragon Precinct, Unicorn Precinct, and Goblin Precinct, are all available now. The short story collection will be out in the spring, and then Griffin Precinct, the fourth book, will be out probably in the fall. And I got some other stuff in the works as well that I can't really talk about yet. But again, if you go to my website at decandido.net, there's ordering links for all the current stuff.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that's great. Well, Keith, I really want to thank you so much for coming on. It's I've been so thankful for just the Star Trek authors in general and their kindness for giving us their time. You know, your work has been some of my favorite over the last few years. And I want to thank you for coming on. And
thank you so much for joining us today, Keith.
Well, Chris, that was an interesting and excellent interview with Keith. So much fun to get to talk to the authors and just be able to pick their brains, one, and two, just really hear the what goes into writing a Trek book.
It really is interesting. You know, I have often over the years aspired to write at least Trek short stories, if not novels, on my own. And I have had ideas here and there over the years. But until you talk to the authors like we are, you really don't realize all the behind-the-scenes stuff, all the work, all the thought process that goes into writing these novels. So it really is fascinating.
I definitely agree, and I can't wait for next week. We're going to have another great interview, get the chance to talk to Una McCormick, who just authored the recent book in the Typhon Pack series, Brinkmanship. So it should be a great interview. Really looking forward to that as well.
That sounds excellent. I can't wait for that myself. Well, Matthew, let's tell everyone where they can contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on, you know, anything we talked about today. Just go over to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there, and that'll come to Matthew and myself. And, of course, you can find us all around on social media over at Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm. You can find us on Twitter under username trekfm as well. And, Matthew, what if people want to talk to you directly?
Yeah, I'm all over the Twitters. So if you hit me up at MattRushing02, give me a follow. Let me know you followed me, and I'll definitely talk back to you and talk about all sorts of things. Obviously, Star Trek right now is huge. Star Trek Into Darkness, The Hobbit, Man of Steel, whatever you want to talk about, I'm your man.
Excellent. Yeah, and if anyone wants to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And if you follow me, send me an at reply and say hello. I'll certainly chat you up. Always happy to talk about Star Trek, college football, Design Japan, all kinds of stuff. ALF, also, if you're a big ALF fan, let me know, because I'll definitely talk to you about ALF. And that famous cliffhanger. But anyway, you'll find me there. And be sure to drop by trek.fm as well. We have 10 shows on the network devoted to everything from the series themselves, discussion of the episodes, to discussions of the creative work outside of Star Trek by those who worked on the show. So there's something there for everyone right over there at trek.fm.
And don't forget to give us a follow as well on the iTunes, a review there as well. We really do appreciate all those who already have. It does help people just find the show. And so we would love to have as many listeners as possible who love Trek books to be able to find our show on iTunes. So thank you so much for those who have already given their reviews. We really do appreciate you listening.
Absolutely. So until next time, everyone, enjoy your books, and we'll see you on the next Literary Treks.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.